I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest today is Alice McDermott, the author of 8 acclaimed novels, the winner of a National Book Award and a 3-time Pulitzer Prize finalist. Her latest book is a collection of essays in which she explores how great writers employ their tools, a rumination on the unique nature of the act of reading fiction, what writers owe readers, and a how-to guide that takes up questions large and small about the ideas and ideals that animate great writing, and even the proper use of the semicolon. But make no mistake, this is no academic lit crit tome. This book is a delight for word nerds of every stripe. It's called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. Alice McDermott joins me to talk about it after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is the acclaimed author Alice McDermott. She is the winner of a National Book Award. 3 of her novels have been finalists for the Pulitzer Prize, and she's garnered many other prizes and accolades in a career that has spanned 40 years and counting. She's an insightful observer of the passing parade, and I guess when all is said and done, I look forward with excitement to each new novel because her prose is simply a delight to encounter. Books like Charming Billy, After This, Someone, or her most recent novel, The Ninth Hour, have afforded me some of the most enjoyable and enlightening and wonderful experiences of my reading life. Alice McDermott has long been revered as a teacher of writing as well, serving for many years on the faculties of the Johns Hopkins Writing Seminars and the Sewanee Writers Conference. Her latest book is a work of nonfiction in which she proffers what might be dubbed a Bill of Rights for readers and a how-to guide for writers. It's a celebration of great writing and an investigation into what makes great writing great. It's called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. And Alice McDermott joins us on our digital line from Bethesda. Alice, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom, and thank you for those lovely words. I'm not sure I should say another word after that kind of praise.
Well, you know, now that we've established that I'm like a, you know, teenage fanboy for your work, that's all well and good. But really, it's one of the great things about this gig is that I get to, you know, talk to people whose work I really admire, and yours is absolutely one of those bodies of work. I mean, it's had a profound effect on me, and I'm really blessed to be able to say it to your face. It's just great, you know. So
I will store that up for dark days when the sentences are turning themselves inside out.
And the dark days are bound to come, as you write
Absolutely.
About in this book. So let's start with the title, because the story behind where the title comes from is really fun. And, you know, it's an unusual title, so tell folks what it's about.
Well, briefly, it arose out of a little tale a friend of mine, another writer, told me years ago about how she had volunteered to run a cinema discussion group at an assisted living home. And the first film that she chose was Julia, the story of Lillian Hellman's Pentimento brought to the screen. And there's a scene in there where the Lillian Hellman character, played by Jane Fonda, is meeting with her friend, the Vanessa Redgrave character, Julia, passing along some money for the resistance during World War II in Berlin. And Julia mentions that she has had a baby, but she has sent the baby across the border in safekeeping with a baker. Movie goes on, Julia dies. We see Jane Fonda trying to find the baby, going in and out of bakery shops. And she never does, and the voiceover tells us that. Well, my friend finished the movie and was certain that all these ladies who were of that World War II generation would have wonderful stories to tell about their own experience. But all they wanted to know is, what happened to that baby? What about the baby? Forget all this war and peace stuff. Forget all these big themes. They were very upset that the story had told them about a baby and never resolved what happened to the baby. And when I've told my workshop, my writing workshops, this story, it became a kind of shorthand for any character who goes missing or is dismissed or is exploited by the author for some effect, sort of had their humanity diminished to serve the author's ends. And so I noticed among my students, all they had to say when they were looking at a short story by one of their fellow writers, they'd look up and they'd say, "What about the baby?" And everybody knew what they meant. Somebody's missing. So it's really about what readers expect of writers and what writers owe their characters, full humanity, no missing babies.
Yeah, no missing babies. I think that's just terrific. And the first chapter of your book is What I Expect. And it's like, okay, I've picked up your book and gosh darn it, you, the writer, you better deliver. And I wonder, and I think that's just a terrific thing. And I was fascinated in your perorations about the experience of not only writing, but the experience of reading and what writers and readers owe each other. And I wonder if your expectations about a book or about a writer's work have evolved a lot because of your profession as a writer and because of your deep involvement in reading?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that they evolve. You know, one thing I've learned through all these years of teaching is that almost everyone I have ever encountered who wants to be a writer because first they were a reader, because they read something that felt so important and so essential or so involving or enlightening. So I think that initial encounter with a book that touches you deeply or changes your life or at least changes the moment in which you're reading it is the thing that spurs any of us to want to be writers. And I think that initial, once you've had that experience, you always are looking to reproduce it. So you always have that expectation. It's not always met. And sometimes you just want to read something because you're on a long train ride or a plane and you just don't want to think about anything else. But I think once you've had an encounter with words, a novel, a short story, a piece of literary art that touches you, that expectation is always there. So I don't know that it's changed. I think it's always seeking after it. You know, it's a kind of addiction once you've had a taste of it.
Absolutely. You quote E.M. Forster, who wrote a book called Aspects of the Novel, and he said that the ideal reader brings two things to the novel, memory and intelligence. And when I read that, I thought, you know, off the top of my head, that seems like too short a list. It seems like we must be bringing more than just that to reading, but maybe he's right. I don't know. What do you think?
Yes, yeah. I quote some of the smartest people. You know, it's always a good thing to do if you want to make yourself sound smart.
Right.
quote the smartest people you can find, and I think that's true. I think that's enough. I think memory and intelligence, but I think the thing that we sometimes forget these days, because perhaps we're, as readers, we're more used to other media in which we just sit still and we're bombarded. Reading is always collaborative. There's no such thing as a writer who doesn't need a reader, because anything you write just remains marks on a page until a reader encounters it. And that encounter is always just between two. You know, there are no pop-ups while mm-hmm. while you're reading a book. There's no third element. There's the reader and the writer. And that is always a collaboration. And I think the best writers respect their readers in that way and trust that to bring intelligence and memory is quite sufficient. But please bring them, because because without
Sure.
it, we're just talking to ourselves.
Yeah. And you note that there's no duplicating the experience of reading a novel. There's no equivalent experience to hearing the voice of another human being who is speaking to us from the silence of the page. And when I read that, I said, yep, that's exactly right. And later on, you talk about the process of both reading and writing, I suppose, is the effort to come into full awareness of what we've always known. And in that sense, you're writing about this in your chapter about the corollaries between faith and literature, and that's a slightly different subject. But coming into full awareness of what we've always known, that was my experience when I was reading that passage, because there really isn't anything like reading. And I liken it, because I was a professional musician for 45 years, I liken it to the experience of hearing music. And in that way, for me, it's a kind of an ephemeral thing. I read a lot of books. I don't necessarily remember everything about, or sometimes hardly anything about the books, but I just remember how I felt. I remember how good a feeling it was to encounter those words. Is ephemerality a problem? I mean, do you hope that, I suppose, everybody reads your books and just remembers every detail about it? Or is it broader than that? I'm just wondering if I'm cheating you by not remembering all the names of the characters in someone or something like that.
You know? Oh, not at all. And I like the parallel that you make with music. But I think this is true of all the arts. And again, maybe something that we lose sight of in our appreciation for them. It's the experience of the moment. We're sort of puritanical these days in that we should read to become better people, that somehow reading literature is going to improve us, make us more successful or what. And sure, an argument can be made for that. I think if you spend a lot of time in English departments, you find out that you can read a lot and still be a petty person. but that sense, I think what we miss in talking about, literature as self-help, we miss the experience of that moment, of being immersed in a story, in a character's point of view, hearing a voice that isn't our own, in the intimacy of our minds, the quiet of our minds, for that moment. Seems to me that's sufficient. That's sufficient joy. I can hear music and be transported, but I sure as hell can't reproduce it. I'm a musical illiterate, but that doesn't mean I can't have the experience while I'm listening to it.
Sure.
So I think I think there's a case to be made. And maybe this is what I worry about in the way literature is being taught in schools. There's a case to be made for just read it.
Yeah.
Don't ask what I'm going to be like when I come out, when I get to the end of this book. And I'm like, no, think about the journey. Think about being there and relishing the experience that only the written word can bring you.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I remember in your book, Someone, I think it's in Someone, I would have to look this up, but you're describing the character's eyes. I even think we talked about this one of the times that you were on the show. And you say, all eyes are beautiful. And then you proceed to describe this character's eyes in all sorts of emotional ways, not at all physical ways. It wasn't about the color or the shape or the hue. It was about her feelings. And I thought, all eyes are beautiful. That is just, it's something I already knew, but it was great to hear it because I didn't think to say it, and you did, and I thought this is great, and it's like that experience for me was like a great chord progression in a Beatles tune or a Beethoven piano concerto. I mean, it's the same. I just felt the same way. So I think you're exactly right about this business of reading to better yourself. I gave up on bettering myself a long time ago. Right. Maybe that's it. But yeah, that's great. The book is called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. My guest is Alice McDermott. And you write, Alice, that the role of doubt, which I was fascinated about. You say that the creative process, like the process of faith, begins in doubt and is also continually sustained by doubt. What do you mean by that?
You know, I think it's a matter of aspiration, perhaps, is the simplest way to put it. I think for a writer embarking on a poem, a story, a 600-page novel, you know, starting out, there's a sense that there's a right way to tell this story. I don't quite know what it is, but I will write to discover it. And throughout the process, and I've heard many writers talk about this, and I quote Henry James again, quote smart people, you'll always be good. We work in the dark, we do what we can, our doubt is our passion, is what James, the way James put it. But the process is always, I think there's the right way to tell it. I'm almost sure of it. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm after it. I'm aspiring toward it. And I get glimpses of it, and then I despair and say, no, I'm tossing this out. No, that's not as good as I wanted it to be. And I think there's a real parallel for people who are pursuing any faith or spiritual life. There's a sense that if I think there's something out there. I think there's a way of understanding experience in this context. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm going after it. And if you find it immediately, for a writer, if you say, perfect, I got it, this is beautiful, chances are you've written a clunker. no surprise, nothing that you didn't know before you started out. And for the reader, no surprise, nothing the reader didn't know before you started out. But when there's doubt, there's always that going, make it better, try again, you know, take a step into the darkness of doubt and see what you can get. And I think people who are trying to understand our existence, the world, through any faith, the language of any faith, are doing pretty much the same thing. It's a groping in the dark until every once in a while you say, oh, I think I see it. And Saul Bellow said, again, I quote Saul Bellow in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, it comes and goes. You know, we have this sense that we're connected to something bigger. We have this sense that we can see the perfect form for this work of literary art. And then it disappears. And yet we continue to pursue it. Yeah, that's the parallel for me.
Yeah, that fleeting nature. Yeah, maybe along with self-betterment, we should punt certainty as a thing that we should aspire to.
You know,
just chuck all this stuff. Right? Alice McDermott, we're talking about her new book. It's called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. We'll have more with Alice McDermott. We'll take your calls and comments when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1. WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the award-winning author Alice McDermott. We're talking about her latest book. It's a peroration on what it takes to write well and what writers and readers owe each other. It's called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. To join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. So, Alice, you have a great chapter called Sentencing, and you say that story and character, of course, they're important, but it's the careful, original, felicitous use of language that is rare and wondrous. And I couldn't agree more. It's how those sentences are put together. And later on, you talk about an editor you encountered one time who said, "I'll spare me the beautiful sentences." And you said, you know, I kind of see his point. And I thought, well, I don't. You can't give me enough beautiful sentences. It's like garlic and chocolate. You can never have too much, you know. But I don't. When he was saying, "Spare me the beautiful sentences," was he worried about overwriting? What are people worried about it from that point of view?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. I think it's the intentional going after beautiful sentences that trips up more writers, especially beginning writers, who, again, because they've read beautiful sentences and they love language, that's what drives them to the page. And then suddenly it's all about the language, and story and character fall away, and there's a kind of self-consciousness, which is for me the poison in the poison pen when you're telling a story. As soon as self-consciousness slips in, the author is aware of himself as author, as genius, you know, as prophet, whatever you think of yourself. As soon as that slips in, then the author's no longer putting himself at the service of character and story and language and reader, but is the be all and end all. And that's when you get sentences that just don't ring true. Eudora Welty says there has to be something inadvertent about all beauty. And I think that's true of beautiful sentences as well.
And this notion of truth is fascinating to me, too, because you write a lot about this and you quote a bunch of folks who talk about it. What's true in the realm of fiction? I mean, you say one of your expectations is that fiction is actually truer than life, truer than reportage, lecture, memoir, or a sermon, so that we might listen with our whole being. How is truth, or how is fiction, truer than life?
Well, you know, there are many aspects of that. I've had people say to me, you know, "Oh, you're so lucky you write fiction, you never have to fact check." number one, I write realistic fiction, so I have to fact check all the time.
Right, right.
but there's also, if you're creating a spell, you're conjuring a world. There are no guidelines in this world. When you start to write a story, until you put that first sentence down, everything is possible. You can create anything. You can say the sky is green, and the sky is green, and the reader sees a green sky. But the reader's not going to keep seeing that green sky if the reader doesn't have some sense of why. Or if the writer doesn't have some sense of why. So that's when you get to the truth of the story itself, the logic of the story, the truth of the characters, the psychological and experiential truth of the character that must be provided so that the reader says, "I understand this is a made-up story. I understand these characters are only composed of words, and yet I believe in them." That's when you get to something that has to adhere to a greater truth than simply saying, "Well, it happened," you know, because all kinds of things happen that don't seem believable, but if it happened, it happened. But for the fiction writer, we're held to a higher standard because we are indeed making this up.
That's really fascinating. And you also tell a story about your early writing career. You were studying writing in 1970, and you were tasked with writing an autobiographical essay in which you made up a bunch of stuff about yourself.
Right. Complete lie. Right?
Yeah. So what did you learn from that? That's really fascinating. Yeah.
Well, probably what I learned is that I better stick to fiction. This was a class I took that was called The Nature of Nonfiction, and I thought maybe it would put me on the path to being a journalist. And it was the very first assignment to write an autobiographical essay, and I had nothing interesting that had ever happened to me. But I could write about someone in the first person who wasn't me, but sort of resembled me as far as the professor was concerned, and tell a story that never happened to me, but happened to this I, this fictional I in non-fictional disguise.
Yeah, that really is, it's fantastic that you clearly, I mean, had the fiction bone and not the journalist reporting, you know, truth at all costs bone. And you quote Nabokov, who says to call a story a true story is an insult to both art and truth. And that's really terrific. But of course, when you in the process of writing, you sort of discover what's true, right? I mean, you do assiduous research about your books. I mean, if anyone's read The Ninth Hour, you know everything there is to know about nuns in the beginning of the 20th century. It's this discovering of truth. I guess you quote Flannery O'Connor, and she said, wouldn't it be better for you to discover a meaning in what you write rather than to impose one?
Right.
And so this business of agendas and meaning, you've thought a lot about that.
Yes, and I think this, it's something that I've seen so much as a teacher of writing, that the wonderful things, the magical part of composing a written work always happens when the young or the beginning writer lets go of all the intentions that they started out with. I always tell my students, especially young writers who don't want to be autobiographical, they say, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want anybody to think this is me. I don't want my family to think this is them. I always tell them, look, they're going to think that anyway, no matter what you write. It could take place on Mars and they'll say, oh, that's your mother. but it's, if you're working in language, anything you write can't help but be autobiographical, because that's how you acquired the language, your first language, or the language that you're writing in. You acquired it through experience. You didn't acquire it through study. So everything that went to how you, in particular, unlike anyone else, use language, what you heard, what you read, what the people around you were speaking as you were coming into eloquence, everything that you've experienced as far as how language has developed for you goes into how you compose a sentence, the words you choose, the voices you hear, the rhythm of the sentence. And so all writing in some way is autobiographical. And I think when you're writing fiction, when you have that freedom, you can just make this up, this is all up to you, you begin to tap into, even just in the effort to compose a good sentence that's clear and makes sense, you tap into not only your own experience, but I think a kind of subconscious understanding of your own experience, of other experience, and of the world that begins to show itself through the words that you choose, through the details that you think, I'm just throwing those in because the teacher told me I should use detail. But the detail you use and the detail I use will be different and will say something about who you are and what kind of writer you are. So, you know, it is that composition itself is, I think of it as a kind of incantation. The words matter. And then they bring you to things you didn't know you knew, which is where the reader gets to say, I didn't know I knew that, but I did too.
Yeah, and that's a great, great moment. Alice McDermott is my guest. Her new book is called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. And you're exactly right, I think, about that subconscious understanding of what you knew. What do you say then to the old adage, write what you know? How do you know what you know?
That's why you write.
I'm sounding like Donald Rumsfeld all of a sudden, you know. We know what we know, we know what we don't know. But it's, you know, this whole notion of knowing is, you know, Tolstoy, you quote Tolstoy about when he spoke of infectiousness.
Yes.
And the value he puts on sincerity and authenticity. What did he mean by infectiousness of writing?
Yeah, well, he talks about in his What is Art, which if you think I set the bar high in what I expect, Tolstoy sets it even higher in What is Art. And he talks about that aim of art, all art, is that you have the artist has experienced something, experienced it truly and honestly and deeply, and now seeks to make the reader or the viewer or the listener feel that same experience, be infected by that same experience. And so how do you go about doing that? That's the aim of art, to say, I have felt this, and now you will feel it. It's not your experience, it's your experience of the art, but we'll both come to the same place because we'll both feel it. That's tough. You know, that's a lot to ask.
It sure is. Yeah, that is tough. Boy, that's terrific. We have a caller on the line from Baltimore. Clarence is with us. Clarence, welcome to Midday with Alice McDermott.
Hey, thanks for taking a call, Tom. You know, when you talk about the great sentence, you know, the opening lines in certain books that come to be my favorite over the years, the authors conveyed the mystery in the opening lines. The opening sentences kind of like conveyed the suspense of the story. In particular, comes to mind to me was like, maybe not a great literary work, but Alan Dean Foster's Aliens. You know, it was something about those opening lines, his opening page of the sentences that just drew you right into that. Frank Herbert's Dune was another book that I can call that there was just something about the opening sentence that conveyed the mystery and the suspense immediately, that you were drawn into the book right then and there.
Absolutely.
Same Mario Puth's The Godfather, the same kind of, I can't really give it a word, but it's just something about the construction, as you say, of the sentence that pulls you right in, and the ability to maintain it throughout the book. You know, it's a continuing process with the great sentence, great lines throughout the book that kind of like convey the suspense and the mystery. That's what I consider great fiction. You know, Lord of the Rings was the same way. You know, you just
Absolutely.
Get thrown right into
Absolutely.
It, and you can't let go. But thanks for taking a call. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah,
well,
I very
much appreciate that perspective. And Alice, you write a lot about the importance of first sentences in a novel.
Absolutely. And Clarence is absolutely right. That not only are they memorable, those great first lines, but it's really your first shot as a writer. There's a blank page. Again, there's a world that can consist of absolutely anything until the writer offers that first sentence. And even if it's as simple as it was a dark and stormy night, immediately it conveys this is a certain kind of story, and it can't be another kind of story. And I say in the book what it comes down to, there really is no formula. There are as many great lines and as they are as varied as great books. There's really no formula except perhaps confidence and authority. As I say in the book, call me Ishmael. Tells you, here's a guy with a story, no hesitation. I've got a story to tell. Sit down, shut up, read. And I think that's what the best first lines do. And as I point out often, young writers don't always know what the best first line is until they've written well into the story and then discover it. Sometimes the best first line is on page 3 or 30 or 45 or 400. So it's not all what ends up as the first line in a published novel is not necessarily the first line that was put down.
The book is called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. The author is my guest, Alice McDermott. We'll have more after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1. WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is a terrific writer, Alice McDermott. She's a winner of a National Book Award, many other prizes, and the author of 8 novels. In her latest book, she steps back from telling a story to explore how stories are told, offering examples from the work of iconic literary legends like Tolstoy and Shakespeare and Nabokov, as well as lesser-known figures like Isaac Dennison and Nicole Brown. At least they were lesser-known to me. McDermott has practical advice for writers and insights aplenty for readers as she considers the ideas and ideals that make literary fiction hum and crackle and resonate. The book is called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. Alice McDermott is with us until the top of the hour. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. So Alice, I want to pick up a little bit more on this idea of the first sentence. I remember talking to Charles Johnson a couple of years ago, wonderful writer, won the Pulitzer Prize for a book called Middle Passage. And he wrote a book on the art of writing. And he says, I see the sentence and paragraph as units of energy to be released. And you make the point, as you've just made in the book, that the first sentence places the first limitation on the utterly limitless world of the author's imagination. And I wonder if those two takes on the first sentence are in opposition to each other.
No, I think I love that idea of a unit of energy, and I think that's exactly what happens. Putting down first sentence and then second sentence. I think it was Annie Dillard who talked about. The way sentences sort of fill in from behind, that you should write your best stuff first. Don't hold it back. Something, again, that young writers tend to do. I've got this great story, but I'm not going to reveal what it is until the reader has slogged through 100 pages of my ideas about everything else. She says, get right to it. If it's the thing that is driving you to the page, put it down first. Don't be afraid you're going to run out. It will generate energy, and it will, and the story will fill in from behind like well water, she says. And so I think there is that humming possibility as soon as you begin composing sentences. One sort of illuminates the next one.
How about your own work and how that, your process and how that's evolved? You write about writing your first novel in the basement of a hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And so obviously your writing circumstances have changed over the years, Do you see the precepts that you're writing about in this book, What About the Baby, as being, you know, always evident in your own work? I mean, when it comes to first sentences, have you written a bunch of novels where you changed the first sentence after you were into it for a while, or did your first sentence make the cut?
Yeah, this is the thing that that makes me a little bit sheepish and about publishing a book about how to write. Because every time you begin a new novel or a new story or try your hand at something new, you are a novice all over again. The things that you thought you learned from the first novel or the second or the third, those were fine for those books. But when you start a new story, nothing applies. You have to find the truth of that story. You have to find the way to tell that story. So I always feel when I'm starting out again, and even when I'm in the midst of a novel, as I am now, I don't know how the hell to do this. I have to teach myself how to tell this story. So there's always that it's new, the characters are new, it's a new world, and I have to find the right words and I have to figure out how to tell it. It's a wonderful thing about teaching, because every time I went into a workshop with young writers and I heard what they were struggling with, I knew, yeah, me too.
Yeah. Been there, done that.
Right.
The book is called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction. My guest is Alice McDermott. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Midday. Talk about the distinction between story and plot. You quote a wonderful bit, again, from Forster, who says, "The king died and then the queen died." If you say that, that's a story. But if you say the king died and then the queen died of grief, that's a plot. And
right.
I thought that was just marvelous. Are you conscious of the distinction between story and plot when you're coming up with these marvelous stories that you come up with?
Well, yes, you have to be, because when you go to a cocktail party and someone finds out you're a writer, you will be inundated with stories. people will say, "I've got a story for you. You really need to write it. We'll split the proceeds." we all have stories. We're always encountering stories. And journalism has borrowed plenty of the fiction writer's sense of narrative, so that you can pick up the newspaper any day and have story after story. But I think, and again, this is very much what Forster is saying. What we look for in plot is consequence. We don't always find consequence in life. Things happen, can't explain it. That was a surprise. But because we have the freedom to imagine, and because we're composing, and as writers, we're constantly making choices, we are obliged, more so than the folks in the real world, to make sense of the choices we're making. Why this color and not that color? Why this year is the year your novel takes place and not another? Why is your protagonist a truck driver and not a bus driver? In life, you can't ask those questions. I don't know, it just happened. But when it's creative life that you're creating on the page, the reader has a right to say, there is an intelligence behind the story that I'm being told. And that intelligent creator better know what he or she is doing.
Yeah.
So that's where plot comes up. Then, that's why you told me this on page 3, so that I would understand what happens on page 300. Life doesn't provide us with that. But I think it's even for the writers who are saying nothing makes sense, there is no consequence, there is purposefulness in that. So the fact that every book is the product of a creative intelligence, how intelligent we can argue, there's a scale, but there's still the sense that I pick up a book and it has been written by someone. We never question that. And so as readers, we have a right to say, okay, why are you telling me this down to every detail? And as writers, we have an obligation to allow the reader to discover why we've said that. So consequence, connectedness.
This notion of consequence is interesting. I also had the great pleasure of interviewing E.L. Doctorow once, a long time ago.
Great.
And he had just published a set of stories, and he said that stories are important because they propose life as something of moral consequence. So we make our judgments based on what we learn from stories. So for him, it was there was this angle, this dimension of insight into a basic code, a basic morality. I don't know, how does that notion strike you?
You know, I think certainly in popular culture, we all get a little bit nervous when we start talking about morality of any sort, and morality being delivered to us in clever ways like stories and novels. But I absolutely agree. I think we all seek that when we go, again, it applies to any work of art, but the literary arts is the art that I practice. We seek some sense of what we all know, what we understand, something that we share. It doesn't matter what the subject of the novel is. It doesn't matter who the character is, whether it's a historical novel or contemporary or set in some future time. We're still looking for, again, we talked about it earlier, that sense of, I knew that, but I didn't know I knew it. And I think that's that sense, that moral sense of who we are as human beings, things that we all understand intuitively about life on Earth, being acknowledged and brought to our awareness, even if it's only briefly, through the storyteller's art.
Let's go to the phones. We have Margaret on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Alice McDermott.
Hi. I was blessed to have a high school writing teacher who probably saved my life as a teenager, but I always had a problem on how to approach the editing process. If you think about painting, nobody edits a painting. Oh, yeah, red blob should be in the left-hand corner and not the right-hand corner. I just wondered how you approach editing of your work.
Yes, thank you. I think the trick of that is while you're composing first, second, third drafts, whatever it takes to get the shape of the story down, you lock the editor out. The editor in your head, the editor who you are, if you're a reader and a writer, you're also an editor, whether you like it or not, you keep that editor at bay. But then you invite the editor in once you have some sense of what your story is, of what you're trying to achieve. My editor, who I've worked with for almost my whole career, has a wonderful, gentle hand. And one of my favorite things he does is he will mark a paragraph or a sentence and say, "Is this as good as it can be?" Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best editing question we can ask of ourselves, because we always know. No, it's not as good as it can be. I can make it better.
And you also talk about the importance of rereading what you have written when you sit down the next day to start up again. That's one thing if you're on chapter 3. It's another thing if you're on chapter 23. So, you know, do you reread all of it before you sit down to write chapter 23?
Not every day, but I think it's essential, because everything you add has the possibility of changing what has come before. When we get a novel in our hands, a published novel, we tend to read it from page one to the end. Sometimes we peek ahead, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the way it's composed. As a writer begins to understand her story more clearly, and its complexity and its characters and its setting, anything that's added has the possibility of changing what has come before. And the writer always has to be aware of that and willing to make those changes. I always laugh when young writers come in and say, "Ah, I can't possibly read this book again." And I want to say, "Honey, if you can't read it, why would anybody else want to read it?"
Well, everybody is going to want to read this one. It's called What About the Baby? Some Thoughts on the Art of Fiction by Alice McDermott. Alice, it's always such a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom. Take care.
That's it for us today. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Mallory Pinker-Pierre is our supervising producer. Rob Sivex, our senior producer. Jamila Kremple is WIPR's digital content director. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.